So this is talking with David Dewhurst at Cambridge on 18th August 76. Well, could you tell me, were you an optical astronomer by training? From what you were just saying, it doesn't sound like it.
I had been interested in astronomy since the age of 13 or 14, but I came to Cambridge as an undergraduate at the end of the war when one had to do pretty much what one was told to do.
Right.
I did natural sciences, mathematics, physics, chemistry, and then metallurgy, and stayed on to do research in metallurgy, but I was still very much interested in astronomy and used to come to colloquia and seminars and so on in the astronomy department, and I was fortunate and able to change from metallurgy to what I had always wanted to do when I finished my PhD in 1951, when I joined the staff here as a junior, but very much optical astronomy, certainly.
So, but what was the specific skill that you were going to bring into it? It seems like to me like a pretty big shift from...
Well, I already, I suppose, knew quite a lot about the optical side of astronomy and observational astronomy, and I joined the staff here and started to use the telescopes that were here. And you must remember that then the staff was really quite small. I mean, it was just half a dozen director, six or seven members of staff, and one or two research students. Very much smaller institution than it is now. And we had at that time a 36-inch telescope, which had come to Cambridge in the early years of the century, around about 1910. Professor Redmond, who was then director, said that it came from the Science Museum. That was when the Science Museum at South Kensington was a research department, which later became Imperial College. Redmond, who was director then, said that it came from the Science Museum and should never have left it. But if you learned to take long exposure photographs and got round star images with that telescope, and then you had learned all you needed to do about how to take astronomical photographs. But at that time, radio astronomy was just beginning. There were radio astronomers in the Cavendish whom I knew, who were beginning to produce positions of radio sources, and you know, it was an obvious thing for me and my colleagues in the department here to take an interest in this and start to look in the sky.
Had you gone to colloquia on radio astronomy also? While you were still in the metallurgy?
Yes, I suppose I must have done. There were, at that time, there were many fewer colloquia and seminars, and we seem to have five a week now.
Right.
But then there were two or three a term, which were held here in the observatory, and yes, I read from Mr.
But you can't remember, you cannot remember any specific...
I should have to look back at that. No, it was simply that I knew these people as personal friends in Cavendish. And at that time, I think it's fair to say, and they would not mind my saying so, that people like Martin Ryle, Graham Smith, they were, of course, primarily radio physicists rather than radio astronomers. And well, we're very happy to come and ask questions. There were mysterious things like precession, the coordinates of things seem to change from year to year, and optical astronomers know about such things, and radio physicists didn't. And it also, you know, it one had to explain why when you drew a map of the sky and you drew something that looked like a graph, that declination increased from bottom to top, but right ascension decreased as in the contrary way to what it normally does in a graph. And
right.
It was necessary to explain that right ascension and precession and so on.
Are you saying that they discovered precession through observations and they came to you and saying, why is this source moving?
Well, no, but they themselves would, I suppose, would look at positions of objects in various catalogues and noticed that the position of an object given in the catalogue now was not the same as the position given in 50 years before, and it seemed rather, must have seemed to a physicist a very odd system of coordinates of objects that changed with time.
Well, in fact, some of the early positions, radio positions, are given without an epoch. They just give a position.
Well, this is because the very earliest radio positions, until, as I remember it, Graham Smith determined the four positions.
That's correct.
With the pair of Wurzburgs and the Sydney people. I mean, Mills were also beginning to measure position of a few bright objects with this sort of accuracy. I mean, apart from those very brightest objects, I mean, the accuracies were plus or minus half a degree, and so it didn't really matter.
That's true, also.
Equinox, the observation was.
So what you're saying is that there was a pretty good collaboration between the optical and radio groups here.
Oh, yes.
Was it just you, primarily?
Oh, no, not at all.
Who else?
This had probably started before I joined the observatory staff. Michael Ovenden, who is now at,
University of British Columbia, he's a neighbour of mine.
UBC. Well, Michael Ovenden had been appointed as a junior observer on the staff just before I had. And Arthur Beer, who edits now in retirement, continues to edit Vistas in astronomy. And yes, I think that before I joined the observatory staff, you know, the astronomers were already coming and talking to astronomers. The radio astronomers were coming and talking to astronomers here, asking questions.
So how did it come about that you got involved with Graham Smith's observations and optical identifications?
It seemed to me very interesting. I thought this looked to me exciting. There was something out there that was emitting all this energy at radio frequencies. And the really puzzling thing was that there just did not seem to be anything there.
Right.
There were first identifications with Centaurus. Well, Taurus A, the Crab Nebula, and perhaps that wasn't too surprising, because even then one knew that the Crab Nebula was a very unusual object remnant of a supernova. And so one looked at other remnants of supernovae that were known and said, is there a radio source here? But the real puzzle came with things like Cygnus A and so on. Right. There was something, radio frequencies, one of the brightest objects in the sky, where there just didn't seem to be anything there.
Right.
It's now perfectly obvious, of course, but at that time it was very, very puzzling indeed. And it seemed to me, and to other optical astronomers who were talking with radio astronomers, that this was probably rather interesting and ought to be looked into.
So Graham Smith, having measured these positions, gave them to you.
That's right, yes.
This was the summer of 51, I believe.
I will take your word on that. I should have to look that up.
I'm quite sure of that.
Yes, all right. Yes.
Yeah. And you took some plates with this 36-inch.
And then with our 36-inch, we started to take plates. One fairly obvious idea was that if this thing was faint at short wavelengths, at optical wavelengths, but was intense at radio wavelengths, nothing about the spectrum at all. So perhaps a sensible thing to do would be to take photographs in the infrared.
Right. So between optical and radio?
Between optical and radio. Well, of course, one couldn't go very far into the infrared. I'm talking about 8,000 angstroms with hypersensitized, and at that time very slow photographic plates. And we took some plates with more conventional blue sensitive and colour sensitized emulsions. You must remember again that these were emulsions considerably less sensitive than one is familiar with working with now. And you must also remember that there were no Palomar sky surveys conveniently in the library. If you were interested in a particular area of sky, you had to take a photograph of it, because nobody else, apart from Franklin Adams' surveys of the 1920s, 1910s, 1920s, going down to perhaps about 12th magnitude. There were just no sky surveys at all. You had to take photographs.
So you took these plates, and in this RAS meeting in December 51, you say that the Taurus and Virgo M87 identifications are confirmed.
Yes. There really could be little doubt about those. I mean, the position of coincidence was so close, and the objects were so bright. And, well, one knew at that time that, it was known that there was this peculiar feature in the middle of M87. I don't think I knew it myself at the time, because I don't think it was published in the literature.
It was in the... But, it was a photograph in Lick Observatory Publications, I think, Curtis...
I'm not absolutely sure about. Right. I'm not absolutely sure.
It was pretty
sure
obscure in any case.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it was certainly not then generally known to optical astronomers that there was a peculiar jet-like feature in the nucleus of M87. I think that was the nature of that was only really discovered when Barber and Minkowski, 2 years later, took special plates to show the structure of that. And then, I can't remember which order we did this, but I took plates of both Cas A and Cygnus A. But I had been, neither met or I'd corresponded with your records on this are clearer than my recollections of it, but shortly after that I'd corresponded with I corresponded with Minkowski, who sent me a 100-inch photograph taken with a 100-inch telescope of the region of Cygnus A, which he had taken. And I had the photograph, and I also had the Graham Smith's accurate radio position, and it then became evident that there was a very faint nebulous object.
I see.
In the position of Cygnus.
So Minkowski did not yet have Graham Smith's position.
That was right. That was right at that time. Minkowski had sent me a photograph of the region taken with the 100-inch. We here were about the first people to get Graham Smith's positions. I mean, he just came along and said, well, these are sort of four positions we've just got. Would you be interested to look at these areas? Now, of the Cassiopeia A region, there were no photographs at all, and I took some photographs with our 36-inch reflector, as I remember, on both blue and far-red sensitized plates. Again found that, see, both Cygnus and Cass, they were both Milky Way fields, or very close to Milky Way. At the time, of course, this one made one think that these were probably the same sorts of things. And sure enough, in both positions, there were faint nebulous objects. But with a rather poor 36-inch telescope, on by modern standards, rather slow plates in a not very good sky, one could only say that there were non-stellar objects in the positions of both these radio sources.
But the filaments in Cass, they were a bit off in the position, I think. Or is that true?
Yes. It's perfectly clear now, with later photographs taken with the 100-inch, that what I recognised as a non-stellar object, and it was stronger in the red than in the blue, as I remember, in the Cassiopeia A source, was the bright knot of filaments that is to the north of the centre of the 5-metre arc diameter object. But it was sufficiently close look pretty sure that it was associated with the object.
That's, in fact, I have bought Minkowski's famous 54 paper in a footnote.
They were kind enough to put in a footnote, yes.
They say that the object noted as peculiar by Dewhurst is actually a blend of a star and some brighter spots of the northern arc of nebulosity.
That's right, yes, that was perfectly right, yes.
So what did you make of it when the Cygnus thing obviously was sort of a, if it were a galaxy, or did you think it was a galaxy, or what?
No. I had no idea that it was a galaxy at all. The definition of the plates was not good enough. And one just did not expect to find a galaxy in that low galactic latitude, and knowing that there were supernova remnants, one thought that probably this was one tended to think that this was probably a galactic rather than an extragalactic object. And it was rather later that it became apparent that extragalactic object for Virgo A and then the Centaurus A, NGC 5128, may well realise that galaxies too. But you'll remember that both Virgo A and Centaurus A are optically very bright galaxies. They're both NGC galaxies. But here was Cygnus A, a still stronger radio source. And this wasn't 11th magnitude, 12th magnitude, this was 17th magnitude.
Right.
And even when you made a guess at what the obscuration would be, it didn't look like a galaxy.
Right. And from your plates, you couldn't even, all you could say was that it was non-stellar.
That's right, right. Yes. Right. Yeah.
So, I gather then that you reported this at the December 51 RAS meeting.
Yes, I spoke about that.
What sort of reception, was there a lot of excitement about this?
I don't think so particularly, because I don't think it was, at the time, it was not a particularly exciting discovery. I simply said that I'd found two faint nebulous objects associated with these two radio sources, and nobody knew what they were, and it was an interesting observation, but you couldn't say
it wasn't clear what this was going to lead to. But now, when did you hear about the 200-inch photos, which Bada took that same autumn? I believe that what happened is Edges looked this up. Smith has given him letters that Smith wrote Bada and with the positions, and very soon, September 51, which I'm not sure exactly when your plates were taken, but probably about then also. Bada found, obviously with a better instrument, was able to pin it down better. And when did you hear about this?
I think probably through Graham Smith. Graham probably rang me up or called in my office and said he'd be interested to see this letter that I just had from Minkowski. But I think perhaps the general comment that we'll make about this time is that, insofar as I claim any credit for what I was doing at that time, there were rather a small number of optical astronomers in the world who thought that what the radio astronomers was doing was going to lead to something. There were one or two of us here, and there were one or two people, notably Barber and Minkowski, with, of course, access to large telescopes and so on. In America, and really that was about all. There weren't many optical astronomers who were particularly moved to any excitement by what the radio astronomers were doing.
Do you have any idea why this was?
There were only a very limited number of radio sources discovered.
But of course, there was more than radio sources. There was galactic background radiation, there was solar emission.
Yes, that was true. It's an interesting question. You have to remember that astronomy, certainly in this country, was in a very fragmented state after the war. Astronomy had not been a large discipline before the war.
Mm-hmm.
Unlike the situation in America, and indeed unlike the situation in other European countries, astronomy in the United Kingdom virtually stopped in 1939. Astronomers just went off to do either into the forces or to do scientific war work or to developing optics or military purposes and things of this kind. There were no astronomers trained from 1939 to 1945, until even later than that, until first research students, I suppose, started again around about 1947, 1948. Mm. So there was almost a 10-year gap in which no astronomers had been trained, very little astronomy had been done. Telescopes were dismounted, observatories were closed down with just a small caretaker staff of elderly or retired people. And the first thing that one had to do after the war, 1946, 1947, was even to start doing astronomy again.
Right.
And I suppose there was little possibility of getting new equipment, so the equipment that had been dismantled or put under dust sheets in 1939 was brought out again and dusted off. There were few people, there was little money, and I suppose people tended to pick up the threads of what they had been doing before. And there was a lot of work to do, and there were all sorts of difficulties. It was a difficult time. There was still rationing and shortages of this and shortage of money, and things like special scientific plates for particular purposes were quite, you know, unthought of at that time. And I suppose it was partly still the consequences of recovering from all that time during the war.
Well, that certainly must have had quite an influence in Europe, especially.
But
I wonder, though, even without the war, if the same attitude might have prevailed. I mean, would you not agree that radio astronomy was so qualitatively different, weird antennas and all, as opposed to the classical
astronomy? Oh, this was certainly true. Radio astronomy started in America, not in this country. I mean, Gans here, Reber. And at that time, when I first came into astronomy, of course, I looked at those papers by Reber and Gensky. But even at a time when there was no war, and when there were large telescopes in America and people interested in galactic structure, they didn't raise a great deal of enthusiasm, even in America,
and they tried.
Before the war. So there's a little bit of that too, undoubtedly.
It seems to me that it was just so different that optical astronomers just didn't know what to do with it. After radio had been there, then you had X-ray, infrared came along, and they were able to be amalgamated or assimilated.
Yes, I think what really made the difference was when the radio astronomers first started to produce positions which were of accuracies of the order of minutes of arc rather than degrees of arc, when you really could begin to look at the sky and say, well, it looks as if it is this object.
Right, that makes sense.
And so I think if one had to pin down anything, it was the first determinations of accurate positions for a handful of bright sources by, I think this is there, by a few by the Cambridge group and a few by the Sydney group, and then the possibility of making identifications that there was no doubt at all that some of these objects were galaxies.
Right.
And this really was exciting. An object so far away
with one of the
objects that radio frequencies were the brightest objects in the sky just seemed unbelievable.
Right.
Perhaps it still does.
Now, in a talk to the British Astronomical Association, you talked about the probable nature of the unidentified radio sources, you know, the 99.9%, and I'm just wondering, in the abstract, you didn't say what you said, but what were you thinking at that time?
Do you know, I haven't the faintest idea what I said to the British Astronomical Association in when?
May 53.
I suppose if I looked back in papers,
I might
discover some notes about what I actually said.
Well, can you remember in general, in the mid-50s, what were you thinking that all these unidentified sources were? Were they just the same Cygnus A's that were too far away to be detected optically? Or
I suppose,
were they radio stars in our galaxy?
Yes, I suppose it was becoming apparent that these things, they were either nebulous objects in our own galaxy, and then, of course, if they were at some distance, the optical object would be obscured by the dust in the plane, and maybe the radio and the radio frequency would not be. And that some of them, of course, could be extra galactic objects, maybe bright objects in low latitude again, where the radio frequency radiation got through and the galaxies didn't. But I confess that I may be being wise here after the event.
Yeah.
And if you ask me now what I thought radio sources were in some date in 1953 or 1954, just before the publication of Varda and Minkowski's major paper on a detailed investigation of the four bright sources, without going back to sort of look at what I might have actually written down on the back of an envelope,
it's tricky to say
at that time, yeah. I fear that my impression of what I ought to do before
right.
may be closer than what I did.
That's the trouble with this whole interview method,
of course.
Yes,
yes.
But in any case, you were not directly working on that in terms of publishing papers on the nature of the unidentified radio sources.
No, at that time it was a small observatory staff. We were still in that position. It was very largely a solar physics observatory, and when I joined the staff, I did recognise that one of the things I was expected to be doing was solar physics, and I was even at that time, and continued for quite a long time after that, to work in areas of solar physics with Professor Redman and other colleagues on the staff.
Did you
so it was very it was very much a part time occupation for me at that time. I was interested
right,
in this.
Right. Did you get involved at all with the radio burst and such?
No, the work that was going on in the observatory at that time, partly picking up the threads of the pre-war work, and Professor Redman was just coming to director, and he had interest in solar physics, were more on sort of straight optical astronomy and eclipse observations. I went off with Professor Redman and others to the Sweden eclipse in 1954, for example.
Right.
And that's what I was mostly doing at the time.
Well, tell me about the next major step in the optical identifications that you were involved with.
I suppose this came from, I mean, I knew the people who were building the 2C, well, starting on the what became known as 2C, the second Cambridge survey, and the research students. John Shakeshaft, for example, and David Edge.
Edge was in 3C.
No, that was 3C. Who were working on 2C at the time. Again, as these positions became available, we looked at these areas of sky to see whether there was any object there. But It was fairly apparent, I think, all the time that the positions were never quite good enough. I mean, if there wasn't a bright object there, then the radio source position had a sufficient probable error that you could not say which of several or numerous fainter objects it could be. And it really only began to look possible. I think the optical identifications only really began to look possible when the sort of position accuracy that was associated with 3C became available. But Minkowski was interested and visited Cambridge, and there was a suggestion that I might take, you know, the sort of first positions that began to become available in around about 1956, 1957.
First 3C position
was that perhaps these were now getting good enough that it was worthwhile. And of course, at that time, a large part of the Palomar Sky Survey was then nearing, it was well advanced, and the plates were there in Pasadena. And so the suggestion was that I might go and spend some time in Pasadena, take these positions with me, or my Cambridge radio colleagues would continue to send these positions to Pasadena,
right,
and that I could look at these regions on the plate. Now, as it turned out, even that was still just a little bit too early.
But what were the accuracies? 10 minutes?
We're talking about plus or minus 10 minutes of arc, and plus or minus two or three minutes of arc in right ascension. I mean, better for the more intense sources, of course. But, of course, we know now that some of those things were 17th, 18th, 32 pulsars, and one hadn't got a hope. But what did become fairly apparent, and I was more convinced, I think, by the feel of the situation than, you know, by the actual number of results produced, or what one could regard as certain identifications, that it was fairly obvious that big elliptical galaxies and one kept sort of finding one or two double elliptical galaxies, and this could not this was a real coincidence. I mean, this wasn't just a sort of statistical... Well, it was statistically significant.
Right.
Even with the sort of small number of positions.
When you say double, is that what has been called a sort of dumbbell?
That's right, yes, sort of pairs of elliptical galaxies, or brightest elliptical galaxies in groups of galaxies like NGC 6166, things of that kind. And this looked pretty reliably established, but it was still disappointing and tantalising that one could have some bright elliptical galaxies, but you could have a nearby source, same region of sky, high galactic latitude, same sort of radio flux, same sort of accuracy in the position, and there was just nothing there at all that one could say. And all the time one had this, I think everybody who's done identification work of this kind at that time, I remember talking with other people who were interested in this, there was this nagging suspicion at the back of one's mind that on those plates there was something staring one in the face, but it was so unexpected that one was just missing it all the time. I remember this used to worry me. In fact, it turned out that this was not really so.
Right.
I mean, the thing was...
You were looking for the right sort of things.
We were looking for the right sort of things.
Right.
But what was particularly worrying at the time was that, of course, one looked at an area of sky of 50 square arc minutes or more than that, because you have to remember that these were interferometer positions. Mm-hmm. Well, you remember the way that sort of
right.
CC worked. And there was uncertainty about which of the lobes the objects might be in. There was the greatest probability that it was in central lobe. But there was this uncertainty, that, and so one had to look in the side lobes too, because there was quite a good chance that the object might be there.
So you looked at the lobe shifted positions as well as the main position?
Yes.
You didn't look in between though, you just shifted one
no,
lobe?
No, right. One felt that one was reasonably confident that it was either in this lobe or one of the adjacent lobes, so that one was in fact looking in three positions at the time. And then at about the same sort of time, for some of the more southern objects, the Mills Cross began to produce positions which, in retrospect, one can make sort of reasoned statements about this, the positions were not as accurate as the Cambridge 3C positions. But what they did have, which the 3C positions did not have, was the lack of ambiguity. And so it became possible, by taking the Mills positions, to say which lobe the thing must be in.
I see.
So the first Mills, the Mills positions were very helpful. They didn't always work, but they were very helpful in removing this ambiguity in the lobes. And so, I met some of the Australian radio astronomers, and particularly Pawsey, Joe Pawsey, who was visiting Pasadena at that time. I must be careful here, I don't want to get into the sort of personal history of this situation, but it was a rather interesting situation at the time, because the radio astronomers tended not to speak directly with one another. It's understandable they were sort of fighting for funds, in some cases from common sources, but there were a few people in a few places that were, so to speak, neutral ground, and optical astronomers were neutral ground and could move freely from one radio astronomy group to another. And also places like Pasadena were neutral ground, because at that time the radio astronomy and really got going. From John Walton. Running equipment and building equipment at Orange Valley, but hadn't at that time come into this particular aspect of radio astronomy. I think that
was the early 60s.
I think that would be a fair statement, I think. And so I met Pawsey in Pasadena. He was visiting from Australia. And he said, instead of going back to Cambridge again, why don't you bring your notes on the areas that you have looked at and bring them back through Sydney, and then you can take and then those cross positions, and maybe this will remove some of these low ambiguities, and we can sort of look sort of further.
I see.
And this idea. So I continue moving.
So I continue. You were talking about before.
That's 1957, 1958.
Right. You were talking before about published Mills positions, and or were you getting ahead of yourself when you said?
I was running ahead of myself there. The other thing that I was interested in doing, that I was, of course, myself, I was spending quite a lot of time, and it's a very tedious business looking at these areas of sci-fi objects. And of course, I myself, although not a radio astronomer and pretending to know knowledge beyond the sort of rudimentary principles of how nose crosses and sort of interferometers and so on worked, I knew sufficient about general principles. And I was very much interested in a quite independent way of taking Cambridge positions and Mills positions, Sydney positions, from an overlap area of sky near the equator, and doing my own private discussed it with the radio astronomers and sort of made the results, published the results of my investigation. I think I spoke a little bit about that at
the Paris Symposium.
Paris Symposium in 1958, I suppose. But I'd I was interested in just for my own private information of saying, well, now.
So what did you?
Which of these areas shall I look at? If I found that there was a 3C position and a Sydney position which were sufficiently close together in our deck that they really both looked intense and they both looked as if there really was something there, then I looked at this area of sky with considerable more interest and enthusiasm than a rather weak Cambridge source where one didn't know which lobe it was in and where. Sydney people swore there was nothing there at all, or at a Sydney position which was not very accurate, where the Cambridge people told me that they were perfectly confident that if there had been anything there, they would have found it. Yeah. Well, both groups were right and both groups were wrong in a way that became apparent a year or two later. Problems of confusion. Limitation and on the one hand, and on the other hand, with the single beam, nose cross arrangement, the difficulty of giving a good position for a weak source on a sloping background. If you've got a sloping radio flux background and a weak source, then that gave you a very poor RA. And it became apparent later.